This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. Have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to. It is a growing, expanding base. Twitter at kpcgfm. You can follow us there. Also email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today. And to start today, we have this ongoing poll that Abraham is you have on Twitter. And I'm trying to find the best name for our Grant's upcoming unborn child. And we're not finished yet. There's still about a day left, but we have an update on the results. What do we have so far?
Yeah, there's about 22 hours left, so if you want to put in your input, then you still have a chance to at Abraham Blondeau. You can find it on there. But yeah, so some very interesting choices. A lot of people going for the unusual. Even Grant's mother has put in her input, and I'll save that for tomorrow, though.
Oh, boy.
But it looks like the least popular name, I have the on the poll, there's the four most popular names of 2017, two boys, two girls. Liam is the runaway right now.
Oh, I like that name.
And for the girls, Olivia is the least popular.
Oh, well, that's sad.
Yeah. So no offense to any Olivias out there, but it seems like people don't like that one as much. But there's been lots of name ideas ranging from Muhammad to Tobias. And yeah, there's just lots of...
Tobias?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll have the full details tomorrow. And then, of course, Grant, you'll be obligated to pick one of those names.
Yeah, at the very least, everyone who listens can call my child that at any time, regardless of the gender of the child.
Yeah, I know that your real name is such and such, but I always considered you to be a Liam.
It looks like Liam's going to win, so anyone can call him Liam, him or her Liam.
He'll be a Liam to us. So you can vote on that if you'd like to, or throw out your idea there at Abraham Blondo on Twitter. California has a lot of traffic snarls from time to time. Hopefully we have some people listening right now in California at kpcgfm.fm. And this is a issue that happened over the weekend. Landslide buries California's scenic highway near Big Sur. S-U-R, not S-I-R, by the way. On Saturday, more than a million tons of rock and dirt fell down the slope and into the ocean about 8 miles north of San Luis Obispo. So pretty interesting picture there. You're driving down the road, and all of a sudden, hey, there's a giant rocks there. We can't go. It buried that whole part of the highway.
Yeah, the aerial photograph's really interesting. It looks like this huge rock thumb came and just put it over the highway because it looks like the mountain just goes into the sea. So it's, I don't think anyone was on the road when it collapsed or when the mountain fell on it. But good thing because... it just looks just huge catastrophe.
You do see those signs in certain parts of the country when you're driving where it says, you know, I forget what exactly the sign is, but you get the idea that a rock may fall on you. And if you're driving in some of those mountainous areas. And I wonder about that, too. Actually, when I was out in California, you see some beautiful homes perched on these cliffs overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And the tremendous views, and it looks awesome. But there is the chance that it could fall down into the ocean. So I imagine the insurance must be out of this world because everyone knows there's a chance that could happen.
Yeah, and even if no one necessarily is killed or hurt by those types of shutdowns, those do change lives. Even last week, I think there was about a 400-mile stretch of highway in Wyoming that was closed because of blizzard conditions. At the end of May, there were blizzard conditions there, and apparently some people who were coming here for the college graduation on Sunday barely even made it in time because they were stuck in their truck for a day and a half.
Wow. Well, yeah. I mean, they always tell you to pack things in your car for certain things that could come up, but you don't expect a blizzard in May.
Right.
But I suppose it depends what part of the country you're going through, and if you're going through a mountainous area, there's always a chance, I guess, of something like that. Speaking of mountain tragedies, Mount Everest tragedy, four bodies found in tent at the highest camp. That raises a death toll this climbing season to 10 in the latest disaster at the world's highest mountain. The four climbers may have died from carbon monoxide poisoning after turning on stoves inside the tent without sufficient ventilation. Of course, Everest is 29,030 feet. That's the summit they're trying to get to. So 10 have died this climbing season. There's always a risk of that. Not that you'd ever want to die, but I suppose if you if you had your preference, you'd rather die like falling off the mountain or I don't know. But you don't think of carbon monoxide poisoning, but lots of things can happen up there.
That seems like something that probably wouldn't happen at, down at ground level. Turning on a stove in your tent, I can't imagine that happening in a regular circumstance without the high altitude being involved.
Yeah, very possible. Less oxygen, lots of things to consider there. So I guess that's part of the intrigue to try to do it, because there is a chance you don't make it. To me, that's a great sign to just not ever do it. But for those that are braver than myself, I don't know. They're still drawn to the challenge.
Yeah, I guess some people, some of them are professional climbers. All they do is climb mountains. And if you love it, then you want to conquer the hardest possible challenge, and that would be Mount Everest. And so these things are tragic, but they do serve as a warning to people who are in that business that there are lots of things to consider, lots of situations to avoid. And so although these things are tragic, they do help save lives in the long run if people pay attention to them. So it is always a risk, though, and I suppose that's part of the payoff if it is successful, is that you overcame that risk.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw a news report a few years ago on free climbers that don't use ropes or anything. They just scale up these different – they're not climbing Everest, but they're climbing pretty high areas. And it just scared me even watching it. You know, the guy just pulled over because I think he was just driving around. He was going to climb. And he was with the news crew, and he pulls over. And I look at it, and to me it is just a straight sheet of rock. Like, I see no way to get up that thing. And he just, you know, runs right up the thing. I mean, he doesn't run, but you know what I mean? He climbs up it.
Wow.
And the thing to me is that I think the mental discipline, because in your mind, you know, one wrong move and I'm dead today. Is it worth it? Is it worth it? And it takes a while. I mean, they're up there for a while and they have to be disciplined and very strong. And I think the mental discipline, just to block out that reality that you could die with one wrong move, that to me seems like the hardest part of it.
Yeah, even just thinking about what it would be like to fall off a mountain that's almost 30,000 feet tall, not those free climbers, because usually they're not doing Everest in that situation, but I'm not even anywhere near Mount Everest, and yet if I think about the fact that it would take a couple minutes to fall that far off the top of Mount Everest, that's just terrifying.
I would be very good at free falling.
Yeah.
But you can only do that once, typically. So that would be my contribution. I'm always just amazed by those people that do it. It's interesting. If you've ever watched that show American Ninja Warrior, which is pretty interesting, I think they have new ones in the summertime. And the people that do the best on it are usually rock climbers, because they have the right strength, the grip strength that you need. They're usually the right height, weight ratio, and everything. And those athletes tend to do the best. So it's an interesting show.
Yeah, there was. I just saw episode last week at my in-laws' place, and they're making a big deal about him. He was dressed up like a ninja. Mm-hmm. He could blow the fire, or like that was his trade. And they had this little intro about him. He made this big deal at the beginning, and he lasted like 5 seconds.
Yep,
and he was done.
Pride comes before the fall, and that does happen with some people where they do really hype them, and then they wipe out on the easiest thing.
Yeah.
And you know, given 10 more times, they probably get it all 10. They just happen to misstep or miss, you know, whatever. And but that is funny. And I think they always do that. I mean, they always show those on purpose just to kind of show you, like, hey, you know, this isn't a given. People could make a mistake.
Yeah, that is always one of the funniest parts of those shows. It would seem like maybe people would be a little bit more cautious about making these bold proclamations when they've never even been on the show before,
right.
But they're acting like they're the greatest of all time.
Yeah, when you guys watch that, do you get like sort of that hankering for 5 seconds to like, I'm going to build a little thing in my backyard,
oh, definitely.
And run around and jump on the clothesline?
I haven't, but I know plenty of people who have, and at the gym I work out, there's some people bringing like their young kids in there and they're playing, because there's like a gym next to the workout place, and they'll be like, hey, Aaron, can you like film my child when he does a ninja challenge? And just on like the pull-up bar, like going back and forth.
Yeah.
And because the kids think it's cool, and it is, it would be really fun just to try it out and see if you could actually do it. Because it is just, obstacle courses are always fun, especially for young people who actually have hamstrings and knees.
Right. <so. laughs> Well, really, I mean, the best, and you guys will, you know this, or you'll find this out as your kids get older, but the toughest workout in the world for an adult is the playground.
Yeah.
Because you haven't been there in a while. So you take your kids, and you're like, oh, yeah, I'll run around the playground with you. And, you know, after a minute or two, you're like, I'm going to die. You know, you don't have the you're not a kid anymore. So you're not, like, pulling yourself up and rolling around and doing all those things that you used to do. So when I think about, like, fitness and workouts, I think, man, if we all had recess again as adults, you know, you got 30 minutes, go to work on the monkey bars, we'd all be in better health or dead. One of the two.
Well, it would sift out the week, I suppose. But there's... I have a warning, though, about being an adult on the playground because everything is a smaller scale. And I was playing tag with some kids. We were babysitting. And the kid was taunting me. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to get you. Because I can outrun them easily. He's like 9 years old. So I'm like, why are you taunting me? So he was like doing all this stuff at me. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to get you. So I went and I pushed off my foot. And I didn't notice that there was a monkey bar at my head level.
Oh.
And so I hit it and I clotheslined myself and I landed on my back. And my glasses went flying off, and I didn't feel like there wasn't a whole lot of pain. It wasn't terrible, but I have a small dent in my head now from that. So it was just a warning about playing on playgrounds. Don't let the taunting kid make you not aware of your surroundings.
Run you into the monkey bars. Yeah. Yeah, whenever you're mixing adults and kids in some sort of activity, there's a danger. We had that years ago. We were doing an inner tube type of weekend, and a couple of guys, we were on an inner tube heading down the hill, and there's a little kid right in the way. And it was one of those moments where you see them, they see you, but they were too afraid to move. We couldn't stop, and we just plowed into. I mean, they were okay, but yeah. You know, there's that moment of like, oh no, we're going to just absolutely annihilate this kid. But everyone walked away. It was too cold to feel any pain at that moment. Probably felt something the next day. But so anyway, maybe it was training us for Mount Everest. But that's for those that are wanting to climb, be careful. Another four dead there in Mount Everest. So the UK, obviously, major terror issue there over the last few days. And different ideas about how to solve the problem. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But right now, they are under sort of it's not really a martial law, but I mean, it's lockdown security. There's troops in the streets. So it's a different UK than we're used to seeing.
Yeah, I forget what the name of the operation is, but they are under the critical heightened threats. I think another attack could be imminent. And so it is odd to see troops in the street. It's not completely unprecedented, though. London is a very violent place historically, so there have been plenty of troops roll through there. But it is something you don't want to see in wartime or in peacetime when we're not at war with another nation state. But I think... I saw some tweets where people saying, well, have we lost? Why are there troops in the streets? And that's one opinion people can take. But at the same time, we do have to adapt to terrorism, if that means trying to stop the terrorists with troops. I mean, you have to be careful what you do there, but I'd rather have the troops take on terrorists and not civilians.
The headline here from thesun.co.uk is Fortress Britain. It says Manchester bombing triggers security crackdown with soldiers scrambled to patrol Westminster as they join armed cops in a race to foil imminent second terror attack. So they have some intelligence where they think something's going to happen. A total of 3,800 soldiers are ready to be called upon to be deployed to Britain's streets, and 984 troops have already been dispatched. So you'd want to be real careful what you were doing there on the streets. You wouldn't want to draw any attention to yourself in a bad way. It reminds me of post 9/11 here in the States, flying a few months after that. And when you get off the plane, you have the soldiers there with the machine guns. Not used to seeing that entering, you know, an airport in, I think it was Utah. I was going to Salt Lake City. Fox News says this, Manchester terror attack, 3 arrested as UK braces under critical threat level. So life, I suppose, goes on. Yet everyone's keeping their eye out.
It does seem like a more serious response than usual there in Britain. But that's the problem, is that it seems like after a few days, no matter what the response is there, everything dies down, the headlines go away, and people just return to acting like nothing had even happened at all. It just kind of makes you wonder how extreme things might need to get, how many attacks in a row would need to happen, how often it would need to happen for months at a time before people actually seriously considered the problem there.
Yeah, because this putting troops on the street, and then if, let's say, there's not an attack for another few months, it does give you sort of the illusion that, okay, we solved it. Yeah, I'll put the troops out there, they'll back off, and, you know. So you do sort of get lulled into this false sense of security, thinking that it's been solved to some extent, but it's only delaying it until the next thing happens, it seems like. At least that's been the pattern.
It might be worth even thinking that they are in a time of war, because that is obviously what the other side wants and what they're trying to provoke in a full-on way that would really cause the apocalypse, basically. But they should be trying to prevent a lot of those things before they get too extreme.
And that's the trouble, because if you take that stance of, okay, this is a war, okay, well, then who are you fighting? Is it the random terror, you know, lone wolf, self-radicalized, as they like to talk about? In this case, they say this guy is part of a network. They're coming out and saying that, some sort of a terror network. How do you fight a terror network and not go after the people that are feeding into that network, potentially? That's where their hands are tied.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, because the UK has a special history with terrorism, and that is the decades of fighting the IRA. So it was terrorism, wasn't against Islamic terrorists, but it was terrorism on a far more violent scale that has been seen from Muslim terrorists. And so Britain does have a history. They do have a lot of precedents to look back on. And interestingly, we ignore them all, or the UK is ignoring them, I think, which is a huge problem. And that's because terrorism is an insurgency. And what I mean by that is during the Iraq War, and any time any nation has fought against terrorism, you can't treat it like a normal war, because you're not fighting people in uniform. You're fighting people who are in civilians hiding amongst other civilians. How do you decide who's an enemy and who's not? How do you defeat them? And it is using different methods, and it takes a lot of time. But the key to it all is going to the source of it and destroying it. And that can take a long time, but it has to be done. And so that's what the Britain tried to do with the IRA. They sent in, they maybe didn't do it the best way, but they did send in the SAS and other special forces with troops. The special forces dressed like civilians, and they try to get inside the networks and then either assassinate them or learn about where they live so they could arrest them. That's what you have to do with terrorism as well, because it's the same thing, just different type of people, I suppose. But you have to go and attack it head on, like the British did with the IRA. And the difference is the base of operations is in Ireland this time. It's in Syria. It's in Iraq. It's in the Middle East. And so the only logical conclusion then, based off of the UK's own success in fighting terrorism, is to go fight in the Middle East, like America did in Iraq fighting Al-Qaeda. And it takes a long time, takes a lot of money. But the only time Al-Qaeda was on the run and we were actually stopping terrorism around the rest of the world was when we had a significant amount of troops in the areas where they had their base of operations.
Yeah, the way they're dealing with it now in the UK is sort of like, and the US has done this too, I guess, is it's like if you're going to weed your garden, you're just pulling the weeds off the top. Well, they're going to grow back, and there's going to be, you know, two where there was one. You got to go get the root. And we know that from just general gardening, and it's the same thing. It's just hopeless. It's this hopeless cycle where you're never going to get the weeds out of your garden until you get the root out, like you said. And so right now they're just trying to take a scissor and cut off the tops. Well, okay, but they're going to come back.
That does show an extreme lack of common sense to allow millions of the enemy to just come in freely without even having to invade, and then to just think that they can somehow control that. I mean, all the different stats and surveys have shown that a huge number of Muslims, even if they're not involved in terrorist activities, are also still supportive of those activities. And that's why there are certain communities that are described as no-go zones in Britain, because even though not every single one of them is putting on the suicide vest, they're still harboring terrorists there, and they're still extremely hostile to the British way of life. That's just something that never should have been allowed to happen, that because now they're in a lot of trouble, and it is like they have to just go and infiltrate the infiltrators. They have to get inside those networks like Abraham was talking about, which is a really difficult task. It's a lot easier to attack the source and to make sure that the war is not being fought on your own land.
Yeah. It's always interesting to me, too, when after an attack they say they have intelligence that there's another threat. How come they didn't have intelligence about the first one? You know, and I'm not trying to be critical of the intelligence. It's a tough thing. It's just interesting how now they've, for a few days anyway, their attention is on it. Well, what about the day before it happened? No one was talking about it then. It seems like that's always the way it goes. Everyone's on high alert the day after. Well, it's a day too late.
That terrorist was on a watch list, though. Just nothing was done about it. They didn't know for sure if he was about to carry out an attack, but they still knew that that was his inclination. That was at least something that he would be leaning toward doing. They just didn't know when or where, obviously. That just raises a question of what do you do with people that are on a watch list, like the 3,500 in Britain that are.
Yeah, it's a tough thing because politicians, you know, they're in by the will of the people, and so you're trying to please all these different groups, and that system is being taken advantage of. So we'll have more about that here in a little bit. There's a lot about that on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host, Stephen Fleury. They're right there in Edstone, England. That's not too far away. And so they're experiencing this, to some extent, this new feeling in Britain there over the next, or last few days anyway. So some great information there coming out of Edstone. Make sure you listen for that coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Archives are online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Also, we have the Trumpet Hour program for you today. And make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today is economists warn South Africa against land seizures. That's something that's been going on for years. Related to that, South Africa, farm attacks on the rise. Some really horrible situations there. And South Africa, where corruption, rape, and murder are normal. Those are the top stories there at thetrumpet.com. Other things happening in the world, even though our attention for now is on terrorism, there's problems in all kinds of places. So make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Before we get into your story, Grant, here's one note that might be of interest to our listeners. If you have an iPhone, T-Mobile wants to help you pay it off, but there's a catch. Would you believe that there's a catch?
No.
To the promotion? But it might be valuable to somebody. As part of a new promotion starting May 31st, which is just a few days, any Verizon customer, if you're a Verizon customer with an iPhone 7, 7 Plus, 6S, 6S Plus, SE, you can bring your phone to a T-Mobile store, and the phone will be paid off by T-Mobile. They want you to switch. However, Verizon customers are required to pay a $15 a month T-Mobile Premium Device Protection Plus Insurance package program. So they'll pay off your phone for you, assuming you switch, but you've got to pay $15 a month to insure your device. So that might be worth it for some people. I don't know. Anyway, if it does help you out, then there you go. If not, so be it. The offer is only available in the U.S., and customers will get the remaining amount owed on their iPhones in a digital prepaid MasterCard. I want it in cash at the store, in Bitcoins. MasterCard in approximately 15 days after they trade in their device. So anyway, sometimes you can play the different companies against each other and maybe get a little better deal on your phones.
Yeah, I did see an interesting story where they did a review of the iPhone 7 versus the new Google Pixel, their phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the Google Pixel actually was better in a lot of the categories than the iPhone was.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see. It'll be hard to market against iPhone because a lot of people just like the iOS software and it's just the trendy phone, I guess. But mm-hmm. Some companies are catching up, and I think most Android and Google phones, they can do everything an iPhone can, and sometimes they're cheaper. And they might have better packages like from T-Mobile and other places.
Yeah, I had an iPhone for quite a few years, and then I've got a Galaxy, Samsung Galaxy, just because I just go with the best deal. I'm not loyal. I mean, I have no loyalty, just the best deal. It does the same thing for me. It's a little different. You got to figure out, oh, I press this button instead of that one, but it's all the same to me, so it's worked out fine there. And yeah, they're coming out with all these different devices. I'll be interested to see if they get bigger or smaller, or they always go these different directions. It's funny too with the iPhones because they call them like the plus. What about the minus?
Even smaller.
Once there's a new one, the old one should become the minus. But nobody wants the minus phone.
Yeah, well, actually, Nokia, they're in the UK and the US, I think they're releasing the old S300 or whatever it's called, like the old, really old Nokia phone that was pretty much indestructible.
Yeah.
They're releasing it again. Some people are buying it for nostalgia's sake.
Yeah.
But, yeah, those phones, you could put them in the dryer, you could run over them with your car, and they're pretty much still the same. So it's, well, some people just like the old ones.
Yeah, a lot of people, it's interesting. It's like the struggle people have had with cable. They don't want to buy the whole package. They just want a couple of channels. And so some people are moving away from cable because of that. It's sort of similar with phones. Some people just want a phone. They just want to be able to call people. That's it. Or maybe call and text. But you can't get that anymore, really. You have to get, like, the full meal deal. You can't go a la carte and be like, I just want to be able to call, text, and check my email. Could I get a cheaper phone? It's hard to find those.
Yeah, it's almost impossible, especially with a lot of the major phone companies that they make their big money off of data. A huge amount of calling and texting is really inexpensive, but even if you have 1 gigabyte of data per month, that's like an extra $15 on the top of the plan at least, and that it's almost impossible to even avoid getting any data on the phone unless you downgrade to a phone that's so primitive that it's impossible for it to even have the capability to have any data.
And then you run the risk of being phone shamed.
That's true.
You have to explain yourself in crowds. Oh, what's that? It's a conversation starter. I have actually seen it happen where somebody pulled out an old phone and people, strangers, were like, what? And it was, so they just started a conversation. So maybe that's a good thing.
Well, I did that the other day. I pulled out my phone that I don't know what it is. It's an old Samsung slider. It's slowly dying, though. I need to update because it just, it's dying. But anyway, I used to choose a different person each time. I'm like, oh, yeah, this was Stonewall Jackson's phone when he died at Chancellorsville. And it's just a way of starting off a conversation.
Yeah, you assume that people would, A, know who that is, and then be able to put the time period together to know.
Wait a minute. Phones were not in existence back then.
No, that's right. Yeah. That would be interesting to name old phones after historical figures.
Yeah.
This is the Stonewall. It's indestructible, but it only covers a 30-meter radius.
But it will die when you need it the most, though.
Yeah, right. There's some tie into history. Yeah, that would be interesting. One last note today. We'll end on a positive one here, especially positive one. This is from the National Post. 6 bars of chocolate a week could reduce risk of a fatal heart condition. No one is going to refuse that. No
you
one's going
to
say
that again.
Yeah. No one's going to say, oh, really? I've got to eat the chocolate again?
Yeah, this is good news for a lot of people. This is from Harvard, and they think that eating chocolate bars of chocolate, so like one per day of the week, can actually help reduce the risk of heart conditions. And the research is based on more than 50,000 people, and they have that there's a strong link between eating chocolate regularly and having reduced risk of heart problems. And they think it's because chocolate has a high amount of flavonoids, which help strengthen the heart. So now obviously there's lots of different chocolate out there.
Yeah.
It has to be like the dark chocolate,
sure.
Not the plastic chocolate.
Chocolate ice cream doesn't count.
Yeah, exactly. But they do find that if you eat about 30 grams of chocolate six times a week, you have a 23% lower risk of getting problems that can lead to fatal heart attacks and that sort of thing. So that is good news for a lot of people. And I think people eat chocolate anyway, but if you, too much is a bad thing.
Sure.
Just like wine, drinking a little bit of wine every day is good for you, but too much is bad. Same thing with chocolate. A lot of people like it, it's good. And if you eat just a little bit of it 6 days a week, you can prevent, actually strengthens your heart.
I wonder if it's just a placebo effect. You know, where you're just happier, so therefore you're in a better mood, and then you don't die.
Yeah. Well, it could be the case. I think if people, the big problem is we go to extremes. If you indulge in something, then you're going to get hurt by it. But if you just have a little bit here and there, you're happier, you feel more balanced, and you'll probably be healthier.
Yeah. I saw an interesting study the other day about exercise, and they were talking about how even if you overdo exercise, it can actually undercut your ability to lose weight, if you're trying to lose weight. I'm sure at some point it doesn't matter. You could, if you did enough, you'd lose the weight. But they're just saying, if it's something where you're really stressing yourself out and going too hard all the time, your body doesn't respond great to that. And if you relax a little bit and are a little more moderate, which is always what you always come back to, right? More moderate, then things tend to go a little bit better. So some people are preaching that a little more, and it's a biblical principle, moderation.
Yeah. Moderation, all things. And so it's with this, you have to be careful with, some people might have a little bit of a different situation depending on your condition. But if you go to the grocery store and you want to have a little bit of chocolate, then you don't have to feel bad anymore. But the key is a little bit of chocolate, not the whole shelf, or not Junior Mints or Reese's, or like the stuff where it's just high fructose corn syrup with different coloring in it.
Somebody's looking at you and they're judging, and you're like, hey, doctor's orders. I have to. Dr. Pepper told me to.
Yeah. A little bit of chocolate a day keeps the doctor away.
There you go. So that's always good news. Anytime there's a legitimate excuse to eat a little chocolate, I think everyone would jump on board with that. That's all the time we have for today here on Trumpet Radio Live. We've got to go get some chocolate, actually, right now. So make sure you listen for the Key of David and the Trumpet Hour program and Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming away in a bit. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Wednesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.